thank you very, very much. I'm not sure it's the moment I've been waiting for. Hello, everyone. I'm Elaine McDowell. I'm Class A trustee and currently serving as the chair of the General Service Board. And let me say from the very beginning, it's just always a wonderful pleasure for me to be among the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I must say to you also that if you want to strike terror in the heart of a non-alcoholic, it's to ask them to be the Saturday night speaker. Oh, God. I mean, it's really intimidating, to say the least, to speak before a group of people who have so much practice with this. And for me, who have such little practice, especially in talking about myself. But over the years, and I've been around for a long, long time, I've learned some things. I still have a long ways to go. You know that we talk about Class A's as being amateurs, and we remain amateurs until the very end. But the one thing that I learned is that the way you frame your talk is to begin talking about the way things were, what happened, and how things are today. And that's how I'd like to frame my talk as well. In addition, I think for Class A's, the most frequently asked question is, why are you still hanging around? You know, and especially me, because I've been around since 1992 on this board. But there's a really good reason for that. And that is always part of my story, and I think a part of every Class A's story. So I'll start from the beginning, and from the very beginning. I am a daughter of the South as well. I grew up in a little small town in Lumberton, North Carolina, and I was raised by my grandparents, who were just very spirited people, highly spirited and highly spiritual. And where I began the early years of my spiritual development as well. And I was surrounded by, these were my maternal grandparents. I was surrounded by my mother's sisters and brothers. So I had this huge extended family of uncles and aunts and first cousins. And on those days, go ye and multiply was taken very seriously by that family. And so it's quite a number of them. And but so I had a lot of loving, a lot of nurturing. And although certainly Lumberton, North Carolina was a place that had many limitations, I was always taught that I did not have to be limited by the limitations of Lumberton. And always had a lot of hope, and that if I, you know, lived by, you know, God's 10th commandments, if I really practiced those principles, that I would do well in life. And I truly believed that. And it was a very uplifting kind of atmosphere, one that was always helpful. I also had the wonderful opportunity of being able to live with my brother. He was a son of my mother's previous relationship. So both of us were being raised together down there. And Leroy and I used to fight over air at home. We really did. But once we left home, he was my protector. And if you looked at me the wrong way, you caught it. You know, he was really my defender. So it was just wonderful years. And at the age of 9, I returned to Baltimore, where I was actually born, to my parents' home. And again, because I had been accustomed to this extended family, when I arrived there and found my father's brothers there, it was great, you know, because I was accustomed to an extended family. So I just believed that I would continue to have this wonderful nurturing and this wonderful loving support that I had received in Lumberton. Well, unfortunately, that wasn't true, because there were two of them. The oldest was Willie Lee, and the youngest one's name was Johnny C. And they had very serious alcohol problems. And Willie Lee, I don't even know whether he knew I was around, because when he did work, he came home with a brown bag, and up to his room he went, and that's where he stayed until it was time to come out to get some more or to get to work if he was able to go to work. And so I'd never really ever had any type of relationship with him, and which was, you know, very disappointing. The younger one was friendly enough, Johnny C., and he would give me a smile every now and then. But unfortunately, he drank everywhere. He wasn't quite as discreet as Willie Lee. And so whiskey bottles were all over the place, and my mother was constantly complaining to my father about his brothers who drank too much. And, of course, I was always very apprehensive because I knew that these discussions, these heated discussions, would come about because of Johnny's and Willie's drinking. And so then Willie Lee died. And so I said to my mother, what happened to Willie Lee? I didn't remember him being that sick and that ill. I said, what happened to him? And she said, he drank too much. He was a drunk, and that's what killed him. And it was such a empty feeling. Because remember, I came up from this very uplifting kind of family environment. And so I don't know how much long it was in between the two, but it didn't seem very long. But then I was young, so you can't quite remember. But it didn't seem that it was that long before Johnny C. also died. And so again, I asked my mother, you know, what happened, you know, to Johnny C. And she said, I told you, it's the same thing. You know, they were drunks. They didn't stop drinking, and it killed them. So then, that was my first introduction to alcoholism, and it was one that taught me a very, very strong lesson. So when I went off, so after that time, they were gone, so it was just the three of us at home, and then I went on off to college. Well, when I went off to college, because I remembered about this alcohol situation, I made sure I didn't run around with the fast group that drank and partied. You know, I had this really nice little group that I ran around with, and the sorority I joined was the bookworm sorority, you know. They weren't the partying kind, and that was my kind. And if a young man came to me and he had alcohol on his breath, you know, he had nothing to say to me. I steered clear of him. And then I met this really tall, really dark, really handsome man. Ah, he was awesome. And he really was. And he stopped me dead in my tracks. And I forgot all about any issues dealing with alcohol. But he had a very serious drinking problem. Name was Smitty from Connecticut. And, but me, you know, I was going to change Smitty. I could compete with that bottle. And so I tried my very best. And my very best was not good enough. And so I lost out, and Smitty continued to drink. And we went our separate ways. So after college graduation, I ran into one of his fraternity brothers about a year or so afterwards, and I was still carrying this little torch here, you know. So I wanted to know how Smitty was doing. I figured he was back in Connecticut and, you know, giving that look to somebody else. And and he said, no, that Smitty had died from alcohol poisoning. Oh, my God. And, you know, I was just devastated. But that wasn't enough. Then I went to work at my first job after college was at the city welfare department. And so I was assigned to work with multiple problem families. So you can guess what was the problem that stretched across all those multiple problems. It was alcoholism. And so I'd go into these homes, and there would be these children who were so abused and neglected. And I hadn't heard about you, and I hadn't heard about the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I'd go back to my supervisor, and I'd say, you know, these kids are really having a tough time. What should I do? And she said, you just need to remove them from the families. You need to remove them from those harmful environments. And so I went about removing children, separating children from their families. And that to me was so, so hard to do, because I remembered my childhood and I remembered how important family was. And I can still remember, until I die, I still will remember this pretty little girl, big brown eyes and beautiful Shirley Temple curls. And she was living with her father alone. I don't know whatever happened to her, her mother, but they were living alone. And I wanted them to make it, because he was trying so hard to stay sober, and but he just couldn't do it. And I was placing her in very, sometimes dangerous situations, because she was trying to cook, and she was, you know, barely in elementary school, and she was dirty, and it was just horrible. And so finally I said to him, you know, I have to give up on you too, and I'm so sorry. And the day I went to remove that little girl, and this is the face that I see tonight, that she was clutching, you know, her father. And I had to pry her hands loose from him. And I remembered then that in spite of the alcoholism, she loved him and he loved her. And so after that experience, I'd had enough. You know, I said, you know, I'm not good at this job, and my supervisor's no better than I am. So I need to do something more. And so a friend of mine said, well, if you're really serious about social work, you need to go back and get an MSW. You need a master's degree. That's the practicing degree. So I took that advice, and I went off to graduate school. And lucky for me, one of my professors became the deputy director of the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Agency and recruited me to come and work for him. And I thought about it, and I said, well, you know, this alcoholism has been following me around. I might as well. Because what I neglected to tell you also was that when I was in school, my brother had gone off to the war and came home with all these medals, with Purple Hearts, and with the disease of alcoholism as well. And this brother that I had been so close to, I lost, because I couldn't engage him. And he was like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I mean, when Leroy drank, he drank. And he took us all on. He really did, in a big way. And when I had this offer then to work in the field, then I said, maybe I can learn something and I can do something. And sure enough, I had the responsibility. In fact, Florida was one of my states that I had responsibility for monitoring programs, but all over the country. And as I traveled through the years in monitoring these programs, I would find these programs where the clients seemed to be doing so much better. And I started interviewing them, and I said, how is it that you are doing so much better? And they would say to me, I don't drink, and I go to meetings. I said, you go to meetings? What meetings? And I said, AA meetings. So I went back to the office, and I asked my colleagues, you know, tell me about AA. What is AA about? Well, it's a 12-step program. Well, what's magical about 12 steps? And so he said, well, you need to go to the meetings. They have open meetings. You can go and attend these meetings. And so that's when I learned about AA. I started attending open AA meetings. And I started listening to your stories, and I started hearing about these miracles and the spiritual awakening and the spirituality that you have. Then I had a responsive cord, because it went back to the spirituality and connected with me that were taught to me by my grandparents. Not religiosity, but spirituality. And so I just grew in admiration of this fellowship. Didn't know about the service structure, but I knew about the AA groups. And so when I became the director of the agency, you know, we then made sure any meetings that we held, there was always time for open AA meetings or NA meetings for that matter as well. And so I was very fortunate that we had an advisory council. And one day one of the advisory council members came to me and said, "Elaine, I think you would be an excellent candidate for the General Service Board of AA." I said, "What's the General Service Board of AA?" And so I know they have a board. And she said, "Oh, yeah, there's a whole big service structure." And I said, "Well, let me look into it." So we had the National Clearinghouse for Alcohol and Drug Information. So they had literature, of course, on AA. And I started reading the literature, tried to read the service manual even. But I have to be honest. You totally confused me. And I got really wrapped around by DCMs and why they didn't attend conferences. I was really... But at any rate, I said, yes, I would like to have my name stand. And actually, this person was from New Jersey. And so she sent my name to a person who then gave it to the delegate from that area. And I was invited up by the General Service Board to come up to board weekend. Went up with three other women. With only one vacancy and three of us. So I thought, well, this certainly is not going to probably be me, but that's okay. You know, I'm learning about AA. It was a wonderful weekend of fellowship. And sure enough, I got selected and my name at the conference, and it was confirmed. And here I was, a member of this board. And I'm telling you, I've talked about the way it was, what happened, and that's what happened. I became a member of the Board of Trustees of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it has been just an incredible journey, one beyond any dreams that I have. And I thank my God every day for this wonderful blessing to serve AA. This is a fellowship of, 2.3 million members, it's estimated. Half of them in the U.S. and Canada, which has like 56,000 groups. You know, worldwide membership in 150 countries. And the big book translated into 50 languages, and that number is continuing to grow. And I put the copy of the big book in Swahili under my coffee table so I can say, you see, it is for everybody when my friends come and visit, you know. And I am so proud to be a member of this board. And you know, like I said, whenever I come among you, I feel so much love and support. And it's not here just in Tampa, but I've had the wonderful opportunity to travel around the world as well on behalf of Alcoholics Anonymous. And let me start by telling you a good story. That is, when I got on the board a few years after then, I noticed something different in my brother. And I said to my two sons, you know, there's something different about Leroy. What is it? They said, "Ma, he's not drinking." He's not drinking. So by that time, my parents were elderly, and he was there taking care of them. And so when I went over to the home, I raced up the steps, nosy me. I want to find out what's going on. And I said to Leroy, "You're not drinking." And he called me sis, and he said, "No, sis, I'm not drinking." He said, "I also know Bill W. and Dr. Bob." Well, I just about passed it. I could not believe it. And this man, well, we had to go and get him out of jail because he'd gotten into barroom fights, or he had a DWI or something. He had turned into this very wonderful, loving person who was taking such good care of my parents. And he passed 2 years ago. But before he passed, he had committed himself to them. And I remembered how I used to call to North Carolina, to that extended family, complaining about how, you know, what a hard time he was giving my parents. I would call back then and say, "You know, when you call and check on my mother, I want you to ask for Leroy. because I want you to tell him how proud you are, because I'm so proud, and I tell him every day, because, you know, he's taken such good care of them. He's so committed. And when I think about him, it's no way that I would not be affiliated with you if I had that opportunity, because you gave me my brother back. And for that, I will be eternally, eternally grateful. So that was starting the good stories. And then as I traveled around this world, I saw AA everywhere. I just came back with a trip to India with Greg Muth, who was the General Service Manager, the General Service Office in New York. And I had been invited to attend their General Service Conference. And as soon as I became chair, actually, but because of the world situation, they were going to be in a war with Pakistan, or something outside was going to happen that kept me from going. But finally, this year, I was able to go, and it was the most incredible trip, the most incredible trip. They have doubled their membership in the last 2 years, and it began when Greg Muth and Eva Sanchez, who was heading up the international desk, went a couple years ago. Because I think what sometimes we don't realize is that we are the country of the founding and the creation of Alcoholics Anonymous. We are the country of Bill W. and Dr. Bob. And that means so much to people who are members of the fellowship around the globe. So when you come from the U.S., Canada, it's big time. And they just pull out the red carpet. They are so thrilled. And these people are in every, we must have visited like 6 cities. Wherever we went, they were there in numbers. Not only in numbers, but I had said to them, if I came, I would like to meet with some of the professional community. And they wanted that to happen too. There was a mutual interest there because they wanted the professionals to become involved. So I met with physicians. I met with two courses in the schools of social work there about AA with AA members from India helping me out. And press conferences. I must have given, I don't know how many, 15, 20 press interviews. We met with the Rotarians, with the Chamber of Commerce, with employee assistance programs. I mean, it just went on and on and on. I mean, we were totally exhausted, but they were so energized by having us come from the U.S., Canada. And I think it's going to be a movement. I think it really will just take off and be maybe even a larger membership than what we have here in the U.S. and Canada, because remember, their population is a billion, you know, as compared to ours. But the trip that I really want to just spend a few moments more on is a trip that I made with Bill Archer, who was at the International Desk at General Service Office last year, to Africa and to the small country, well, it's not that small, but it's Central Africa, French-speaking country, Cameroon. And Cameroon has such an interesting AA history. It started because there was a guard there in one of their horrible prisons. It's a prison guard who was an alcoholic, but very, very much wanted to become sober and had tried so hard and couldn't make it. One day he woke up from this, you know, stupor that he was in. And beside him was a piece of paper. And on this piece of paper was information about the General Service Office of AA in France. And so he was so, you know, startled by it. He just knew that this had to be a message from on high. So he got in touch with that office. And that office started communicating with him. And so then, not soon after that, another alcoholic who wanted to get sober in Cameroon, almost the same kind of story, he found a piece of paper dealing with the GSO in Belgium. So he contacted the General Service Office in Belgium. And so the Belgium General Service Office then got in touch with the French General Service Office, which in turn said, we're already working with and communicating with an alcoholic in Cameroon, they want to put them together. And they did. And it was almost like Bill W. and Dr. Bob, these two men, started AA in Cameroon. And the first meeting was held in that prison where he was the prison guard. And so it grew to the point where they had like 2,000 or so members of AA in Cameroon. But they didn't have a service structure to support the groups and no literature distribution system or anything like that. So they got in touch with Paris and asked them, could they help? And Paris then that office and got in touch with us in New York and said, can you help us out? And so we planned a trip then. The chair of the board, of the French General Service Board, myself and their staff, the two staffs from the two different offices, we got together and we all flew to Cameroon. Well, again, when you come from the U.S., Canada, and from France, you know, because of the connection to the French in Cameroon, then they just went wild. I mean, they wanted us to attend every AA group meeting that was going on. I mean, we were up until, from morning until night and with these meetings, and they arranged, again, these public information meetings. We met with the ministers of health because they had a physician there, a Cameroonian physician, very wealthy woman, but very interested in alcoholism because one of her friends was an alcoholic and got sober, okay, in AA, and so very interested in working with them and continuing to work with them. So she was able to open a lot of the doors and were able to meet with a lot of the high-level country officials because they had this custom that if you go into their areas, you have to get permission from the local politicians, so to speak. And so we always had to have those meetings before we could then go into have a public information meeting or meet with the alcoholics in those communities. And so it was a lots and lots and lots of meetings. And but remember, the real purpose was to help them form their service structure, their general service board, and help them with the literature distribution system. And so one day we went to visit the prison for the first meeting was held of AA in the country. And these men living in this awful, I mean, I can't describe the conditions that they were living under. But they so loved AA, and they had become sober in AA in prison, and they had written a song about AA. So when we came through the door, they broke out in song about their love for AA. I mean, it was just incredible. And so leaving there, then we went to visit one of the politicians to get permission to go then into the community, and we met with some physicians and went to a community meeting, had a public information meeting. And then finally, we came to this home where we were going to work on the general service structure. So as we just got seated to do that, these fellows came up with the copies of the big book under their arm to have a meeting. We said, oh, my God, we really have to, you know, we really have to dedicate our time to the service structure. Well, they were really kind of upset. And so one of the Cameroonians said to them, well, why don't you just stay here? You know, it's all right. Why don't you just, you know, listen in on the meeting? It's quite okay. You don't have to leave. And so they did. And we went about then helping them establish their board, which they did. And they elected the physician as the chair of the General Service Board, the first chair. And what's really interesting, because the chair of the General Service Board in France is also female at the time, and there was the three of us females. So how about that? So it made really great photo opportunities, you know, these three women. And so after the meeting, after we had done the work and helped them with the distribution center, the literature distribution system, then the people who had sat in on the meeting, who had first come to have the AA meeting, got up and said to us that they were so grateful because they had just witnessed history. They had just witnessed the, you know, the beginning structure of AA in Cameroon. And they apologized because they thought, well, we would probably want to go on a safari or someplace, you know, and do sightseeing. They had no idea that we really were serious about the work there. And so by the end of that day, we were really beat, you know. It was getting over into the evening by that time. And so this was like a village outside of the capital, which is Yaoundé. So we got back on the little dirt road and then going to the highway to get on the main road that would take us back to Yaoundé. So just as we came into that intersection, this truck pulls up, this little truck with this little hatchback. I don't know automobiles well, but it's like a little pickup truck that has a little covering over it. And this gentleman jumps out, and so one of the members said, oh, that's, well, one of the parish priests. And so he came over to us and said, you can't leave. What do you mean we can't leave? Because, he said, there are 30 members at my parish who've been waiting for 3 hours for you to come and have an AA meeting with them, because they heard that people were here, AA members from the U.S. and from France, and they have been waiting. Oh, God. Johns Hopkins just said, don't go into the bush at night, you know. So we just sprayed ourselves down with all the mosquito repellent we could, and we turned these two vehicles around and started back. And if you can imagine, we left the main highway, we left the dirt road, and all I can say about this thing that we were on was like it was like a little trail. And it had recently rained, and there were mud holes. And today, I tell you, I don't give commercials, but the Land Rover, that was a good land. Because that little thing bounced around throughout these little, you know, this pathway it was, and into potholes and so forth. And, I mean, really into the brush like I'd never seen before. And as we were approaching it, we saw a few of the stragglers. They were coming back, you know, because they had been, you know, waiting for 3 hours. So a few of them had given up on us and were coming down the road. And when they saw the priest, you know, driving and these two cars following him, they figured it was us. And they just jumped up and down. They clapped their hands and they jumped in the back of this little truck. Went a few more yards, saw some more. They jumped in the back. By the time we got up to this clearing, it was like 11 people. I don't know how they stuck back there into this thing. And we came upon this little country parish in the bush that had dirt floors, no electricity. And we walked in the room into the parish, and this lady jumps up all excited, and she her name, and that she was an alcoholic, and I am chair of this group, and there's my treasurer, and there's my secretary. I said, hey, okay. Treasurer, give me a wow. I'd like to see you pass that basket. But anyway, but there they were, and there were faces just like yours are tonight. And but unfortunately, by the time we arrived inside, darkness had settled, and we couldn't see. And so, and they couldn't find candles, and they wanted to, you know, start the meeting. No one could see how to read the preamble. So I thought, oh, boy, how disappointing this is. Well, I want you to know, those AA members picked up these little rickety benches that were their peers and took them outside into the yard of that little parish. And we had the most magical meeting that you could think of. I mean, and there were stories just like your stories. Stories of, you know, losing family, losing homes, losing jobs, the little jobs that they had, lost everything because of the alcoholism. But they, too, heard the healing message of AA and had gotten sober. And they were talking and expressing their gratitude to AA and feeling so connected to the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, because they had people from Paris and people from the U.S., Canada, where both Dobby and Bob W. came, Dr. Bob came from. And they were just beside themselves. And it was just, it was, you know, it was just such an incredible meeting. And I looked up to the skies and I said, you know, it's so true, you know, for anyone who has a desire to stop drinking, AA is there. And AA will work for anyone with that desire, no matter where they are. And so the last meeting that we had was a big meeting, and a lot of the group members came, and some of the professionals came, and they asked Bill and I to talk. And in my talk, I said to them, you know, I talk about, you know, myself when I'm asked to tell my story, but every opportunity when I go back, I'm going to tell your story of AA in Cameroon, because I want everyone to feel connected to you as you felt so connected to us, you know, and you've shown us so much love. And in spite of the diseases, in spite of the poverty, in spite of all the issues that they have, where alcohol is the background, the backbone of their economy in many instances. Remember, they are producers of wine and so forth. But they found sobriety in AA, and they were doing 12-step work. And I said to them, your story will be told over